It is a dark time for Muppeturgy. Mid-episodes like Anne Murray, Phyllis George, and the sinister Jonathan Winters have taken a toll on the brave hosts. During the battle, Disney Plus managed to serve up a not-so-secret episode starring Mark Hamill and the stars of Star Wars, a cast with enough charm to destroy an entire planet. Joined by the often-mentioned, never-before-heard Todd Brian Backus, our heroes race home aboard their starship to record a podcast and restore freedom to the galaxy. Hey everyone, welcome back. We're so glad you're here. I'm David Levy, and here today with me are...
Christy Bauer.
Michal Richardson.
Adam Grossworth.
And our aforementioned very special guest star, Todd Brian Backus. Hey, Todd.
Hey,
Todd Brian Backus is a director, dramaturg, illustrator, and sometimes playwright living in Portland, Maine, where he's the literary manager at Portland Stage. By the time you hear this episode, he will have just closed a production of What the Constitution Means to Me at Portland Stage, and you can also hear him on the Dungeons & Drama Nerds podcast. Todd, tell us a little bit about your history with the Muppets.
So, as someone who was born in 1989... I think my first real memory of the Muppets is of Muppet Babies, and I think is also perhaps where I get my thigh high kink. just wanted to leave that there. But for me, growing up, like, I know, David, you have sometimes maligned the Muppet Christmas Carol and Muppet Treasure Island. They are very near and dear to my heart. But I also saw a lot of Muppet Show reruns, and kind of in a scattershot, out of order way, because I didn't have them on VHS or DVD growing up. So listening to Muppeturgy has actually been really cool, because I've gotten to see my favorite weirdo, Gonzo, go from avant-garde artist to the daredevil that I knew Gonzo to be. And so that's been a really delightful journey, watching along with y'all week by week.
Well, we're so glad that you are here to contribute to probably our most requested episode when we ask guest stars what they'd like to join us for. So you win.
I'm just going to plug this here because it came up. I will be on an upcoming episode of Tough Pigs Moving Right Along podcast, which is currently covering Muppet Treasure Island 2 minutes at a time. Todd, you should not listen to it. If you're a fan, and all three of you have been on that in the past. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So we've all been on various episodes, and you can go find them and listen to them.
And in my defense, it was being on that show that helped me reevaluate and come to appreciate Muppet Christmas Carol.
Lovely.
Yeah. I've come around on Muppet Christmas Carol. I have not come around on Treasure Island, but that's not what we're here to talk about.
I have a feeling that we have perhaps misunderstood the question.
We do have a handful of corrections and additions this week. On the Liza Minnelli episode, we lamented that the Copacabana TV movie isn't available to stream anywhere. Huge thanks to Shane Kay on the Tough Pigs Discord for sharing a link with us. It is on a questionable website, but you can watch it if you want to.
Should you?
And that link has been added to the Liza Minnelli page on our website, so you can find it if you want to.
What an endorsement.
Well, I've gotten partway through it, and it's pretty bad. But, you know, I will finish it at some point.
In the Anne Murray episode, I mentioned that Scooter finally had his skateboard, which we knew he wanted because in the Nancy Walker episode, he had been selling candy bars to try to win one. It turns out it was not candy bars. He was selling magazine subscriptions. I regret the error.
So we got an email from Daniel Moeller. I'm probably butchering your last name, and I apologize, Daniel, a listener from actual Sweden who writes... I was delighted to hear a Swedish version of Yes, We Have No Bananas in the latest episode. The only problem being that it's not real Swedish.
Wah, wah.
It's some sort of Swedish sung in a really silly accent with some German thrown in for good measure. Yikes. Sorry about that, Daniel. And he actually followed up with some more research. He said, the version you played is indeed by a Swede, the comedian Bernt Dahlback. The verses are in Swedish, and the translation tells the story of a Polish fruit store proprietor. So the chorus is supposed to be in a Polish accent, which makes all the German words somewhat inexplicable.
And he even went so far as to provide us with an actual Swedish version of Yes, We Have No Bananas.
Ah!
inga bananer. Inga bananer idag.
There was a discussion of that song on WNYC the other day when they talked about songs going into the public domain, and they were like, does anybody still know this song if they were born after X year? And I was like, everyone who watches the Muppet Show or listens to Muppeturgy, that is what I yelled at the radio. Oh, well.
Here is a Muppet News flash.
Speaking of yelling at the radio, let's do some news. This week, we are talking about season 4, episode 17 of The Muppet Show, produced the week of January 15th, 1980, and it aired in New York City on February 25th, 1980, a very fast turnaround. And I think it was a week later in the UK, but I didn't write it down. It was number 16 in the air order in New York, in between Linda Carter and Dizzy Gillespie. For further context, The Empire Strikes Back will be released on May 21st and filmed at Elstree Studios March through August 1979. Elstree is also where the Muppet Show shot. So everybody was hanging out in London in 1979. In the news on February 25th, 1980, the U.S. hockey team has won a gold medal at the end of the Winter Olympics. This is the famous Miracle on Ice.
I saw that movie.
Exactly. This is why I know a sports thing, and I haven't even seen the movie. Later in the paper, there's a full-page ad that just has big text and says, Smirnoff Vodka salutes the United States hockey team. Well played, Smirnoff. Mrs. Gandhi getting divided but mostly favorable notices. It's been a month since Indira Gandhi was elected Prime Minister of India. And last week it was Mrs. Thatcher. This week it's Mrs. Gandhi. Get your shit together, New York Times. There's an editorial titled, Ask Not How Old the Candidate Is, which I did not read the rest of. But here in 2024, the more things change. This, of course, was Reagan versus Carter at this stage. There's an article on political valets, which I also didn't read, but it was cute what I skimmed. The Dooley Hill's character on The West Wing and Tony Hale's character on Veep are both these people. So I thought that was kind of funny. Are we destroying the Earth's ozone shield? The debate heats up Tuesday in Science Times. Again, the more things change. That one was yes. Yes, we are. Kramer versus Kramer won a lion's share, 9 of the nominations for the 1979 Academy Awards, as expected. But unexpectedly, the tender movie about a father who struggles to become both parents to his 6-year-old son was matched in 9 nominations for All That Jazz, Bob Fosse's glittering hard-edge choreography of his own heart attack. Unexpectedly to who? I mean, the past, obviously, but like, not to anyone on this podcast. There's a fantastic ad for the MSR Command Center, which controls up to 16 outlets using a simple plug-in module and a central command center, which I had to do more research on. Apparently, there were like wall plugs, not unlike a Wemo or other wireless outlet that you would add, you would get now. But of course, it wasn't wireless. There was no Wi-Fi. It all worked through your home's electrical system. There was like a big control box. And if you had these things plugged in at the other end, somehow it could like zap through the electrical wires.
Oh, so like you could have lights all around the room, but control them from one
place. Yeah, all around the house. You could have anything you wanted. The examples they use in the ad are like, you know, start making coffee in the morning. I'm like, I think you need to do more than flip the power switch on to start your coffee maker.
Maybe,
but
not
okay.
With the old fashioned coffee.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, there were a bunch of slightly off examples, but yes, I mentioned this on the Extra Hot Great Discord getting a lot of play today. And a couple of people were like, we had this when I was a kid. We used all our Christmas lights. We're hooked into this. So it was a thing. In theater, Whose Life Is It Anyway is on Broadway, starring Mary Tyler Moore and James Naughton. Mary Tyler Moore replaced the original lead, who was a man. And so there was a bunch of press about how they switched the gender of that character.
She got a special Tony Award for that.
Oh, nice. There is a whole article in the New York Times about it if you want to read more. Tally's Folly by Lanford Wilson, starring Judd Hirsch and Trish Hawkins. I don't know who Trish Hawkins is, but she had equal billing to Judd Hirsch. So thought I shouldn't exclude her. Much like I'm doing with movies, I've started to try to pay more attention to the weird stuff on Broadway. Heartaches of a Pussycat was some sort of French comedy, I guess. It ran for 18 previews and 5 performances. And this was not a metaphor. This was about cats. It's about cats, Hal. And but they're like full body theme park costumes of cats. You can find photos on playbill.com, and I don't recommend it. And something called Censored Scenes from King Kong, a comic extravaganza. This ran 11 previews and 5 performances, and it was much harder to find anything about because of the way, if you Google Censored Scenes from King Kong, you get deleted scenes from the movie King Kong. But it did star Stephen Collins, Chris Sarandon, and Carrie Fisher.
Uh-huh.
That's a title I literally only know because they refer to it in title of show.
Oh, that makes sense.
And they're like the song where they mention all of the flops.
Nice.
Okay.
On the Cashbox pop charts, the number one song is Crazy Little Thing Called Love. The number one album is The Wall. And on TV, on CBS, on the news, on Channel 2 News in New York, New York is up in arms. You'll see why little can be done to halt the sale of illegal firearms, why the hands of the police are tied, what laws New York City legislators want passed, and how some private citizens are reacting to this terror. 1980, everybody.
Good God.
That's followed by She's a Good Skate, Charlie Brown, which I've never heard of. This was its premiere, apparently.
What is She's a Good Skate a euphemism for?
Nothing. Well, it's Peppermint Patty, so I mean, maybe something. But officially, Peppermint Patty enters the world of gulp ice skating competition under the beagle eye of her temperamental coach, Snoopy. Can she cut the ice? Will the Peanuts gang cheer home a winner?
You know, I have no memory of that, but once you said that Snoopy was the coach, I had like a flash where I can picture him yelling at her. So,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, I'm here for the lesbian representation, but it this did not stick around. That was followed by The Last Resort, and then a miniseries, Scruples Part 1. Lindsay Wagner, Barry Boswick, and Marie-France Pizier star in the scorching bestseller about people who have everything except scruples. Also starring Robert Reed, Gavin McLeod, and Muppet Show guest star Connie Stevens.
The more time you say scruples, the less it sounds like something pleasant.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember this was a Judith Krantz novel, and I just remember, like, I think this is how I learned the word scruples as a small child. Like, it was just...
Yeah, we definitely had a copy of it in my house. That was the kind of thing my parents read at the time.
I think there were sequels, like, and yeah, this was a whole thing.
Michal, now I'm hearing there are those shingles vaccine commercials where they're like, shingles can be what? But I'm hearing scruples can be what? Anyway.
Getting vaccinated against doing scruples, great. Everybody.
Do it.
ABC also had a great news ad. Being rich, the rich walk a mile in their $5,000 shoes, get a taste of their $3,500 steaks, visit their dream houses. It's a special report with Roger Grimsby on how the other half of the top 1% lives. Tune in, live a little.
What does a $5,000 shoe cost in 2024? $18,714.60.
Jesus.
Is that a thing that people spend on shoes?
The $3,500 steak stuck out to me even more because, like, what? Why? A whole dinner with, like, wine and stuff, sure, maybe, but.
$3,500 in 1980 is worth $13,181.32 today.
There you go.
I mean, I am about to shell out a bunch for custom orthotics because I've danced my feet into the ground and my insurance sucks, but that's different.
Yeah, I just was like, was this a thing we needed a special report on the news about? Like, Dallas was already running. I don't know. I found this very strange.
What makes a thing a $3,500 steak? Like,
yeah, there's like gold. There's like gold leaf on it. And
the cow hung out with Truman Capote. Like,
it lived a life of luxury.
You know, it didn't say it was beefsteak. The steak could be Truman Capote.
Yeah, it's people. That's what it is.
It's the most dangerous game, Michal.
Yeah, you pay $3,500 to chase somebody around a yard.
Well, but man is the most dangerous game. Somebody else could have shot him. Anyway, also weird, the entire primetime block on ABC this evening is the 1979 TV movie Elvis, which starred Kurt Russell as Elvis Presley, obviously. And the ad copy reads, on February 11th, 1979, 130 million Americans watched three movies on network television. Most watched Elvis on ABC. The rest watch Gone with the Wind and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Tonight, every American can enjoy this special encore performance of the movie that became a television legend. So first of all, it's like, all you suckers who didn't watch Elvis first time can watch it now. Also, like, that's actually not true. That it, like, what if you're out? Like, this is before the VCR. Yeah. Like, if you're out, you actually still can't watch Elvis tonight. It's very weird. I'm almost done, I promise. On NBC, Little House, Sweet 16, Almanzo realizes Laura is no longer just a little girl. Exactly what it sounds like. And the 1976 movie, The Outlaw Josie Wales. On PBS on Channel 13, Rappaccini's Daughter, which is part of a series called The American Short Story that's based on a Nathaniel Hawthorne story. And then another episode of Song by Song, which we've talked about before. This one about Howard Dietz, who wrote That's Entertainment, which we've also talked about before.
Funny story. I did a proposal for my first year end project at NYU based on Rappaccini's Daughter. And I cannot tell you what that story is about.
Great.
Almost wrote a 20-minute musical about it. Cannot remember.
Huh.
Doing great.
Not,
I'm like thinking if you had written the musical, you could probably remember.
Right.
True. It's true.
And on Channel 9, which we have talked about getting artsy or being artsy at this period, a musical fantasy like no other, Jacques Brel is alive and well and living in Paris. This was not a TV original. This was a 1975 movie in which they have framed the generally plotless review as three attendees at a puppet theater don various roles in order to sing a variety of songs by Jacques Brel, all while hippies and other eccentrics cavort around them.
It's a tough sit. And I say that as a person whose handle on all social media is Timid Frida.
Is that what that's from? I have no idea what that's from.
I have seen this movie. I'm not sure that I could have told you that there is a puppet theater in it. Like, I just
remember it being like clowny hippie surrealist nonsense in the like Godspell vein.
I was going to say, it sounds like Godspell, but French. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
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 Well, I did not look up if it was on streaming because I don't plan to watch it.
It was on Canopy for a while. I don't know if it still is.
Believe it or not, with us tonight are none other than the stars of Star Wars featuring special guest Mark Hamill.
Star Wars. Long ago, far away. You know the deal. We'll talk a bit about each of the guest stars, but since throughout the episode and even on the Disney Plus menu, the guest star is described in one way or another as Star Wars, I want to start with a few words about Star Wars and specifically what the 1980 audience knew of Star Wars. So Star Wars was the creation of George Lucas, one of the first generation of filmmakers to graduate from the relatively new phenomenon of film school, for him USC specifically. While he wasn't yet a household name exactly, his film immediately prior to Star Wars was American Graffiti, which made a boatload of money on a very small budget and was nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Lucas. Star Wars was a big departure from the realistic nostalgia of American Graffiti, and it came together over an expensive and challenging 2 years of production in London and Tunisia. The British work on Star Wars, as we mentioned, took place at Elstree Studios, which is where The Muppet Show was made. Star Wars premiered in May 1977 on just a few screens, but it quickly became a blockbuster hit, becoming the highest-grossing film to date, a title it would hold until 1982, when E.T. surpassed it. By the end of the summer, Star Wars had made a significant enough impact that C-3PO, R2-D2, and Darth Vader's footprints were enshrined in front of the Chinese theater, and the movie's run continued for more than a year in cinemas across the country. The film was also well-received by critics and did well on the award circus, netting 10 Academy Award nominations and winning 6, plus a Special Achievement Oscar for sound designer Ben Burtt, who, among other things, is the reason that R2-D2 sounds the way he does. Hmm. The Empire Strikes Back was in post-production at the time of this episode, but it wouldn't be released until May of 1980. So for fans clamoring for more about Star Wars at this point, they had some novels, some comic books, the Star Wars Holiday Special, a truly confounding episode of Donnie and Marie that we will include in the show notes and I highly recommend watching. But that's it. So suffice it to say, this episode of The Muppet Show was kind of a big deal for a lot of people, including for the guest stars themselves, who were thrilled to be working with the Muppets. Speaking of those guest stars, 3 actors from Star Wars are in our show tonight, although only one of them gets to appear as himself. That's Mark Hamill, who also plays Luke Skywalker. He's joined by Anthony Daniels as C-3PO and Peter Mayhew as Chewbacca. Wikipedia tells me that R2-D2 that appears in this episode is the unmanned model operated by radio control. Mark Hamill was born in 1951 in Oakland, California. He moved around a lot as a child due to his father's military service, but after graduating from high school in Japan, he landed at LA City College, where he studied drama. His early acting career included a number of small television roles, including a recurring part on General Hospital. Star Wars was his big break. Following Star Wars, he attempted to avoid typecasting by not only taking on a variety of film roles, but also performing in challenging Broadway plays like The Elephant Man and Amadeus. These days, he is as beloved among a certain segment of fandom for his voiceover work as he is for Star Wars, particularly for voicing the Joker in Batman the Animated Series and a whole lot of other Batman cartoons since then. He actually got his voiceover start prior to Star Wars on the cartoon Genie, which was a spinoff of I Dream of Genie, in which Genie is found not by astronaut Tony Nelson, but by teenager Corey Anders, played by Hamill. He also sings the theme song. There will be clips of this in the show notes as well. Highly recommend at least listening to the theme song. He's still around today, still doing a lot of voiceover work, the occasional Star Wars, and being a generally good guy on social media. Anthony Daniels, who plays C-3PO, was born in 1946 in Salisbury, England. He dropped out of law school to pursue drama and had a career on the BBC and then at the National Theatre before being cast in Star Wars. He went on to become the only actor to have a role in every single theatrical Star Wars film, playing C-3PO in most and playing the role of Tack in Solo. In addition to his work with Star Wars, you can hear him as the voice of Legolas in the 1978 animated version of Lord of the Rings, and you can see him in Helen Mirren's Prime Suspect series. He also teaches at Carnegie Mellon University, and he published a memoir in 2019. Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca, was born in 1944 in Surrey, England. As a child, he was diagnosed with gigantism, which I just now learned is the thing you can be diagnosed with. He also had Marfan syndrome, which theater nerds know is the condition that killed Jonathan Larson, who wrote Rent. He made his film debut in 1977, just before Star Wars, in Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. His day job, though, was working as an orderly in a local hospital, a job he returned to in between making the original Star Wars films. At 7'3" tall, he was exactly what George Lucas was looking for in casting the part of Chewbacca. The part was a great fit for Mayhew, who played Chewbacca in 5 films, but also made numerous appearances both on television and in person, particularly to greet sick children in character. While he did some additional film work outside of Star Wars, he also wrote a couple of children's books and even worked at a timber yard for a while. When Star Wars returned to the big screen in 2015, Mayhew shared the role of Chewbacca in The Force Awakens with Yuna Suatamo, who inherited the role entirely for The Last Jedi, although Mayhew was credited as the Chewbacca consultant for that film. Peter Mayhew died of a heart attack in 2019. Usually at this point, I ask who has memories of the guest star, but that feels like the wrong question this week. So instead, let's briefly talk about our relationship to Star Wars, both the film and the franchise. Adam, as the senior member of our group, you get to go first.
Great. But this actually makes a lot of sense because a couple of my earliest memories actually involve Star Wars. I was a little too young for the first movie when it came out. And I'll just say this for the young people listening. We're talking about Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, except it was not called that yet. It was just called Star Wars. So we're talking about Star Wars. So I was a little young for it, but I remember it was on HBO like all the time, constantly. So whenever there was nothing to watch or I was flipping channels, I would land on Star Wars. And so by the time I was 10, I had seen that movie, or at least the second half of it, over 100 times easily. Empire Strikes Back came out in May of 1980. I turned 5 in August of 1980. And the only thing I remember about that birthday party is that every single gift I received was a Star Wars toy. I think there were 5 identical Luke X-Wing pilot toys. Not that I hold a grudge about this. But yeah, I mean, it was huge. And then, much like with the Muppets, I outgrew it, in the biggest of air quotes. I got rid of most of my toys, which I still regret deeply. And then in 10th grade, I had an English teacher who was terrible, by the way. We all hated her. But she decided to show us Star Wars in class as an example of a hero's journey. And I think like every single one of us was like, hey, this movie from our childhood 10 years ago is good, turns out. And then it was just all over. And I've been an unapologetic Star Wars nerd ever since.
So it's funny. I am just younger enough that I never really had that grow out of Star Wars thing. I grew up not watching it on HBO, but we had taped it on one of its network television broadcasts. Mm-hmm. And like clearly with great care, because it was the sort of thing where you like press pause every time it got to commercials, then unpause when it came off the commercials.
Oh, so the
that
best. We'd have
more of the experience, except it did preserve the like bumpers that they created for that broadcast, which had some of the original cast coming back in costume to like usher us in and out of the commercial breaks. And also, it was like one of 5 movies that I had taped from TV and watched over and over and over and over and over again. But like Return of the Jedi is the first one that I remember seeing in the movies, like at the cinema. And because I have an older brother, most of the Star Wars toys in our home belonged to him, and I wasn't allowed to touch them until Return of the Jedi, when I finally got some of my own. But I was a big Star Wars fan, and like I own a lot more of Star Wars on DVD than you might guess, knowing me now. I wouldn't say I ever fell out of love with it, but like around the time they were doing the special editions, I was in college, and I sort of rolled my eyes at the idea of like paying money to go see this in a movie theater when I had a perfectly good videotape of it in my dorm room, and didn't really get back into Star Wars fandom, as it were, until the prequels started happening, which was also when I was in college. And I remember like with 20 of my friends all getting tickets to see Phantom Menace on the first day, and then like the week before it opened, another friend of mine called and was like, they just added an extra midnight screening on the night it starts. I got three tickets. You want one of them? And so I saw Phantom Menace twice on the first day. Boy, was that an experience.
Yeah.
And yet Hope Springs Eternal, like I saw the next two films, like on opening day at the Chinese theater and like, you know, collected a bunch of the toys from the prequels. And then once again, when the new sequels came out, like I remember being really excited to go see them and kind of recapture that feel. And then as this generation of Star Wars things has happened, I have sort of gradually fallen away from it as I have had my various disappointments where like, even now, like I have not watched all of the Star Wars television.
Oh no.
Because I only liked some of it. When I stopped liking it, I stopped watching it because I'm a grown up and I can make good choices. Anyway, that's me in Star Wars.
funny addition to your story. I was in rehearsal for a play the day that Phantom Menace tickets went on sale. And I remember having to wait for our 10-minute breaks in rehearsal and go to the payphone in the hall to try to call and get tickets, which I eventually did. But very soon after that, I bought my first cell phone because I was like, this is no way to live.
So I don't have a decades-long relationship with Star Wars the way a lot of people in my orbit, as it were, do. I've seen some of the movies. I have absorbed this as a pop culture artifact. I showed you guys pictures of a Purim costume that was inspired by the Star Wars opening crawl. So it's not like I'm unaware of Star Wars and have never consumed any of the media. And having loved some very nerdy people for a very long time, I am aware enough of Star Wars as a phenomenon. I'm sure that I watched some of the original movies as a kid, but I couldn't tell you which ones or how many times. But I watched the first one this week, and I have a newfound respect for why this managed to capture the imaginations of, at this point, so many generations.
So my relationship to Star Wars is an interesting one because I was a kid who loved it and who wanted to go deep on it, but it was a thing where, especially classmates, a lot of boys were like, this is our thing. And with most other things in my life, I was like, fuck you, I don't care, it's my thing too. But with Star Wars, I was like, oh, okay, I guess it's not my thing. And so, like, it took me years to sort of like be like, no, that's garbage, and reclaim it and like really be able to sort of like name like, this is why I love it. And a big part of my Star Wars love is actually due to my love of John Williams. John Williams is my favorite composer, full stop. And I have sort of figured out retroactively that a lot of why I am a musical storyteller is because of John Williams, more so even than the musical theater composers that I love. But I actually, for a project that's no longer happening, got to write a pop punk song about women reclaiming their love of Star Wars. And it made several people, including somebody who was in a position of power at Disney, cry. Because I think it's a very common experience that a lot of women in like fandom and nerd spaces have experienced, of the like the gatekeepy, like, you know, what do you know about Star Wars? You're a girl, blah blah blah. So yeah, but like, yeah, like as you were talking, as you were all talking, I was like, the number of Star Wars things that I have within reach of me at this moment, like,
same,
you know. Like my Grogu fanny pack, you know, I have a Pez. I have like, it's just, I mean, this is literally just like at my desk. So yeah, it's very meaningful to me. And it's a thing that I now very proudly claim as my own, because Star Wars belongs to everybody. The end.
So much like David, and I think this is because my brother is about David's age, I grew up with the original trilogy on VHSs that had clearly been recorded from broadcast. And so much like I have a hard time pinpointing like exactly when I started watching The Muppet Show, I am certain I was watching these movies before I had language. And like in my office right now that I'm recording in, I have an Ewok from the 80s that is like my teddy bear that was probably my brother's, but I somehow inherited and like went with me to college and lives with me now, you know, states away from where I grew up. I have an X-Wing Lego set within grabbing distance in this office. And so Star Wars has been part of my life for so long. The first film that I remember seeing in the theaters was The Phantom Menace, which like, as someone who was very young at that age, it was so exciting to see and like also does not hold up in any way, shape or form. I recently read Claudia Gray's Master and Apprentice, which is this like really wonderful book that contextualizes Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi and like their relationship. And convinced me that The Phantom Menace was a better movie than I remembered it being. And then I rewatched it and was immediately disappointed again. But I'm like glad that Claudia Gray is such a good writer and could write such interesting stories that it made Qui-Gon Jinn feel like a person. And so like I still read a number of the Star Wars novels. I play the Star Wars video games. I remember growing up before the prequel movies came out, knowing about the twins, Janice and Jada, Janice, something like that.
Yeah, those aren't canon anymore. Unlike this Muppet Show episode.
Huh?
They're not canon anymore.
True.
Unlike this Muppet Show episode, which definitely is.
But I've always had a soft spot for it. Like David, I'm a little behind on some of the Star Wars TV shows, and I haven't watched Ahsoka yet, but part of me still wants to because I haven't quite gotten to David's level of adulthood where I can just let it go.
As long as you've watched Andor, that's all that matters.
Love Andor. Oh my God, yeah, communist too. Space twink. Yeah. I love it.
So before we get things started, David alluded to this a little bit in his bios. But we all just like described a world in which Star Wars is ever present. Like even by the end of 1980, I would say that was true. And there is fandom and there is canon and there is all this stuff and lore and Wikipedia, which is, by the way, the best name for a website ever. But there's a pretty good documentary called A Disturbance in the Force, which you can rent wherever you rent streaming things, which is about specifically the Star Wars holiday special. And they do a great job of contextualizing the fact that like no one thought this was going to happen. Like, right, this is a movie that they put out. It was pretty low budget. No one had ever heard of anybody in it. And it became this giant thing. And they were like, it's going to take 3 years to make a sequel. What the fuck do we do? And so they just like, there were no toys. The first Christmas, if you wanted a toy, you got a empty box, literally an empty box that said your toys are coming. They've been ordered. They'll be here in June. So apparently they were just like churning out anything that they could to keep Star Wars in the public consciousness, because then Empire Strikes Back was actually also this huge gamble. Like they didn't know if it was going to work. So the holiday special is the thing that like is most remembered because it aired once and then like was immediately like all the copies were burned, except they weren't. And so it became this like bootleg, you know, videotape that got passed around, and that came out in Christmas of 78. But there were all these other like super weird things, including variety show appearances that nobody really talks about or remembers. But in this period between the two movies, like there was no such thing as canon. Nothing made sense. You must go watch the Donnie and Marie thing. Paul Lynde plays Moff Tarkin. I mean, it's incredible. And then there's a Muppet Show. So like this was part of that. Like this was, I think, more directly publicity for the movie that was coming out in 3 months. But yeah, it was like a weird thing. And I'm excited to talk about it. Why don't you get me started? Okay, now let's get things started. Todd, what did you think of this episode?
I think it's really lovely. I've watched it a couple times in preparation for this episode. And while Mark Hamill is giving us the weirdest Luke Skywalker I have ever seen, I think it's very fun. It's very funny. The Gargling Gargoyle, while I have a lot of questions about his tongue and what it's doing, I think is fun and Muppety, and like I have a good time with this episode.
Christy?
Yeah, if you subtract the UK spot, which I just found dull, I think this is a perfect episode. This is exactly what I want from the Muppet Show. But yeah, but the UK spot, I deduct some points. But yeah, this is probably in my top five. I really had a great time.
David?
I think I like it slightly less than that, but it's extraordinarily charming. And that, I think, is the word that I keep coming back to, where, like, I love that we get to see Mark Hamill be goofy. I love that we get to see C-3PO be goofy. I also really love, you know, we spend a lot of time on this podcast trying to sort of parse out what's, like, really happening versus what is on stage at the Muppet Theater. And this episode blurs all of the boundaries in some really interesting ways, which, like, you know, I don't think was particularly intentional. I think it's probably, like, the exact opposite of intentional, but also makes for some, like, interesting things to think about on the, like, 15th time you've watched it. So it was a lot of fun.
Michal?
Yeah, I love how clever this episode is at, you know, they're being deliberately dumb and goofy, and they're very smart about it. I really like the device of Mark Hamill and Luke Skywalker both being present in the theater at the same time, and it keeps being funny, every iteration of that joke. I love that Angus McGonagall, the Gargling Gargoyle, is written as a one-off joke, and you expect to never see him again after the cold open. And then every time he comes back, it's in a way that moves the plot forward. Like, this is actually clever writing. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, as much as I don't have a deep relationship with Star Wars, but it turns out I love Mark Hamill. He is so goofy and so mm-hmm. game, and it is magical to watch him. I had a great time with this episode.
I tend to find present day Mark Hamill really annoying, like too goofy and too game. And so it was really actually lovely to see him in that mode at this time, which is not a thing I think we got to do a lot. Yeah, I'm with all of you. I'm mostly with Christy. I've fallen behind in my rankings, but this is top five for me, I'm pretty sure. This was a delight. Let's get into it.
Okay, so this week, our scheduled guest star is Angus McGonagall, the tartan-clad gargling gargoyle. And he's raring to go until some bigger stars blast through the dressing room wall and Scooter hustles Angus out the door.
Angus McGonagall, 15 seconds to curtain, Mr. McGonagall.
Yes, sirree, Scooter, little buddy, I'm raring to go.
It's Luke Skywalker and C-3PO and R2-D2 from Star Wars. Oh, they'd make much better guests than Mr. McGonagall. You're going to have to leave.
Just
Sorry.
A minute, youngster.
Come on, let's go.
Excuse me, Master Luke, but what is this strange world we've come to?
Beats me, 3PO. Seems we've landed on some sort of comedy variety show planet.
How does he know that it's a comedy variety show if they're just in the dressing room and nothing has happened yet?
There's costumes hanging on the wall. There's a picture of Dr. Teeth in a frame.
I also, like, okay, dramaturgically, for Scooter to know who Luke Skywalker is and for Luke Skywalker to not be an actor, the Muppet Show must exist in a galaxy far, far away a long time ago.
And the real Luke Skywalker's exploits were somehow broadcast.
Yeah, like, what? I have questions. I know they don't hold a lot of water, but I have questions.
I also question the implication that guests like Jonathan Winters and Anne Murray are equivalently famous to Angus McGonagall.
I mean, do you think if Jonathan Winters had blasted through the wall, Angus McGonagall would have gotten to stay?
That's a good question.
Elsewhere in the theater during our intro, Waldorf is in his box with a sheep.
You're looking a little sheepish.
Me.
These are the jokes, folks. Gonzo doesn't get to blow his horn because a duck barnacles itself onto Gonzo's nose and plays Gonzo's nose like it's a horn.
I think she just bites him.
I mean,
yeah, I think the noise we hear is the duck quacking. Also, a duck? It's the duck.
It's the duck, although her eyes are a little off. And I know that we've seen multiple ducks in this model, so I wasn't sure.
That's fair.
True. No, she looks like she bites him hard. Like, I think even barnacle is too kind a word. Like, she really attacks
him. She launches herself at Gonzo's nose. Mm-hmm. She has a one-track mind, and that track is Gonzo's nose.
I mean, I understand.
The Muppet Show backstage!
Okay, so backstage this week on The Muppet Show, we did have Angus McGonagall, but he has since been canceled.
This is an outrage! I demand my spot!
I don't even know what an Argyle gargoyle does.
I gargle Gershwin.
The Argyle Gargoyle Gargles Gershwin?
Gorgeously!
Well, that answers that question. We'll hear later about a musical number that stars a bunch of sheep, so we also have a recurring sheep motif this week.
Okay, nice flocking, guys. Say, aren't there more of you?
Oh, we don't know.
Why not?
Well, every time we try to count ourselves, we fall asleep.
Yeah.
Steve Whitmire, the man of one voice.
Well, he also does an okay Kermit.
I also just love Kermit's face at how upset he is about this joke.
But he also says nice flocking, which I assume is an inside joke for the Muppet builders, who sometimes use the process of flocking to make puppets like Miss Piggy shiny and velvety.
Oh, I thought using... it was like because they're a flock.
Well, it's sheep, a pun.
They're like being herded. It's both.
Nice
it's
flocking.
Both. There we go.
In context, it is.
But yeah, I don't think that they would expect anybody in their audience in 1980 to understand that it was a double entendre if they meant it at the time. I presume it was just an inside joke among those people. And even having watched some videos today about what flocking is and trying to understand, I'm still not entirely sure.
I think I get it. So flocking is you take
electricity and magic.
Well, you have a piece of material like foam rubber, for example, and you put it in a chamber with like little bits of stuff, and then you run electricity through it so that the bits attached to it, like with static electricity. And that's what makes, for example, Miss Piggy look like Miss Piggy instead of just being, you know, like smooth and rubbery. Mm-hmm. And what we learned when researching this is that flocking was a relatively new thing for the Muppets at this point. They started flocking sometime around season 3. So not all Muppets are flocked. These days you can sometimes get special edition Funko Pops that have been flocked.
Ooh. Or you can get like a My Little Pony that's a hard rubbery thing, but it's also been flocked, so it has a velvety texture.
Yeah.
Mm.
The more you say been flocked, guys.
Yeah, all the My Little Ponies have been flocked. Friendship is magic, you know. They get around.
But the neat thing about flocking for Muppets is that unlike covering a foam Muppet in fleece, which is what they had been doing, flocking enables it's like less bulky, so it enables more motion in the puppet, which is why Miss Piggy, for example, becomes more expressive as time goes on.
Mm.
And less sewing, because covering a bunch of foam in fleece is very time-consuming and arduous and dangerous if you have carpal tunnel already. Just speaking from personal experience.
We'll have a link in the show notes to Jim's Red Book, which is his diary, where he has an entry all about his quest to find a flocking machine.
Yeah, so that's flocking.
And listeners, if you flock yourself, let us know.
But please don't send us videos.
Keep pounding that.
You've got to draw a boundary somewhere. So I know everybody listening knows that neither Angus nor the sheep are the stars of this episode. Nobody can pull the wool over your eyes. The real stars are coming. Don't you worry with EWE.
Boo! Boo! Humbug! Humbug!
You know, later in this episode, I don't think we have a time to talk about this, but there's a very brief clip of Scooter rehearsing his number, and a sheep comes and pokes his head through Scooter's window to heckle him just like that, which is, it's like so short, you almost blink and you miss it, but I love it. But also, it's a very weird moment because the window does not look like it should, it doesn't look open, so it's not clear why the sheep is able to get its head through.
And it looks like Scooter's in an attic, so that sheep is levitating.
Yeah, well, it's a set, so it's both on stage level and has no glass on the window. You know.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
All the above.
I'll also say, my partner was like confused about why there were so many sheep in the Star Wars episode. And it wasn't until the second or third time that I watched it that I was like, no, they're here for Angus. They had a whole show ready for gargling gargoyle.
Yeah.
Who is Scottish.
And this is why we need a dramaturg on the show all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You can justify anything.
Yeah, it all comes together. So when Mark Hamill, our guest star, our actual guest star, shows up, he's in character as Luke Skywalker, but he's in a much bigger space opera mode Luke Skywalker than we would ordinarily see him. He's kicking down dressing room doors. He's looking for Chewie. He's yelling at everybody.
Remember Alderaan! Officers upstairs! Rivio, you cover that exit!
Watch it, I cover the team!
Down with the Empire!
I love what shall I cover it in. It's beautiful. Cover it in flocking.
As has already been mentioned, this is the weirdest presentation of Luke. And like, I understand that the Muppet Show writers wrote it. And that, as we talked about, like, George Lucas was not controlling this stuff yet. But like, you'd think Mark might have chimed in.
Well, I think there's also this, like, this is after Star Wars, but before Empire Strikes Back. And so the end of Star Wars, he's sort of a newly minted hero. And by the time we meet him in Empire Strikes Back, he's more of a soldier than he had been. So like, trying to fill in that gap, it would make sense that he is bolder and a little bit more of like an action hero than he was when we last saw him in Star Wars. But without having any like real connective tissue there, it seems extra.
But like, Mark has already made Empire Strikes Back, even though the Muppet writers haven't seen it. So it's just interesting to me that he just like went with this bizarro interpretation.
He seems like he's having a great time going over the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But who's to say this isn't what he was like when he first got to Hoth? By the time we see him on Hoth, it's like they've been there a long time.
It's very cold.
Yeah. And, you know, their morale is down. And so, you know, some of this vim and vigor is probably been sucked away. But
all I know is my new method of entering rooms is going to be to kick in the door and yell, "Remember Alderaan!"
Actually, weird. I don't think anyone in a single Star Wars movie ever says "Remember Alderaan," and you think it would be a bigger deal. Like after, it's a big deal for like 5 minutes, and then even Leia is like, "Meh, it's a shitty planet anyway."
Yeah, wasn't her dad there?
Oh yeah, her whole family died.
She grew up there.
Yeah,
that's a shame. Anyway, so C-3PO explains the situation to Kermit, and they both commiserate about what an odd species humans are, which is cute.
We are searching for Chewbacca.
Oh, Chewbacca the Wookiee?
Correct. As Artu rightly says, he's been kidnapped.
Kidnapped? Well, why are you looking around here?
We received this hyperspace telegram from him.
What? To Luke Skywalker, C-3PO and R2-D2, help, I am being held prisoner by a bunch of weird turkeys.
It does rather sound like your show.
Yeah. It does.
Chewbacca the Wookiee? No, Chewbacca the Lunch Lady. Like,
here's the thing. It's a solid joke, but I really wanted I wanted to hear Kermit doing a Wookiee voice.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little dismayed that we didn't get weird turkeys with Chewbacca later.
Yeah, he just kind of
Gonzo
appears.
Is the weird
turkey. I think Gonzo's the weird turkey, yeah.
Okay.
They call him Chewbacca the Wookiee throughout the Star Wars holiday special too. When they're on the Wookiee homeworld, as they call it, in that special. So it's just like, this is a thing they were doing at this moment, apparently. I do enjoy Hyperspace Telegram. That just made me giggle. I don't like, it's one of those things that's like so stupid and obviously not correct, but like, I enjoy it every time.
Excellent. So as long as the cast of Star Wars is here, Kermit approaches them with an idea which they are not into at all.
Oh, well, you know, as long as the three of you are here, how about you go out on stage and do a song for us?
What? You must be joking.
Well, look, your little garbage can friend wants to.
Then stop it, R2. Don't be so vulgar. You're not a song and dance droid.
Listen, pal, we're on a mission. There's no way we're going to be involved in any third-rate variety show.
Second-rate variety show.
Kermit just looks right at us and he's so hurt.
He looks so wounded.
Yeah.
I really want to know what R2 said that was vulgar.
I mean, I think he just said he wanted to do a song and dance.
Sure.
And 3PO thinks that's vulgar.
Oh, R2 is like canonically swearing all the time. Like, based on how 3PO reacts to him throughout the series, R2 has the filthiest mouth.
Oh, yeah.
But I'd like to pretend that R2-D2 wants to do like a burlesque number.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm sure there's not.
Let me dance,
it.
Motherfuckers!
So that's when things get weird. at this point in the episode anyway, which is a heck of a thing to say when we've already seen a number at this point in the episode starring doo-wop sheep. But that's what happens. Fozzie recognizes Mark Hamill, or does he?
You're Mark Hamill! Yes!
No. He's my cousin. That's it. He's my cousin, and he's right outside.
Oh, well, go get him! Hurry! I want to see him! Run! Oh, boy! I'm a big fan of his.
Hiya, Fozzie.
Oh, wow! Hey, you know what? You could be the guest on this very show, right, Kermit?
Maybe. What do you do, Mark?
I've been known to do impressions.
Who do you do?
I just love impressions. I just love doing them. Terrific! Who do you do?
Once again, these impressions are better than Rich Little's.
Truly.
Here's where reality has already started to break down. And I don't mean about the doubling of Mark Hamill as the cousin of Luke Skywalker. I mean that Kermit, not 3 minutes ago, said, our very special guest star, Mark Hamill. And now here is Mark Hamill. And he's like, well, I don't know if you can be our guest star. What do you do? Like, come on, Kermit.
Well, he also seems to be lying. Like when Luke says, no, he's my cousin, right? It's as if he doesn't want to be recognized as Luke or as Mark or whatever, right? Like, it seems like a bit that Luke/Mark as a single person are doing together. If that makes sense, which it doesn't really, but you understand.
Yes, he has that like glint in his eye that says like, like time for a bit.
Yeah, well, and there's like the, you know, the everyone on TV is bad at lying trope,
right?
Where he is clearly, you know, being weird about something. So you're right; it doesn't entirely make sense.
It's never going to quite make sense, but I do love that he's been on a mission thus far. Kicking down doors and all that and yelling at people. And as soon as Fozzie says, oh, I'm a big fan of Mark Hamill, he's like, oh, yeah, I'll just go get him. I'll drop what I'm doing. And Fozzie is ordering him around, being like, run, go get him. Big fan. And he just dashes out the door. Forget about Chewie, I guess. Okay, so for the rest of the episode, Mark Hamill is dashing in and out of the frame in two different costumes as both himself and Luke Skywalker. And at the moment, even though Kermit did already announce him as a guest star on the show, he is Mark Hamill. He's in a doofy little sweater vest, and he's auditioning for Kermit and Fozzie. And he's the biggest ham you've ever seen in your entire life, and it's wonderful. And you can't take your eyes off his face because he's having such a good time and hamming it up.
His big Richie Cunningham energy. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like he just wandered off the set of Happy Days and onto this Muppet Show stage.
He is so chipper. It's delightful. Okay, so he already tried impressions, which did not make a great impression. And now he tries singing.
Be my love for only you can end this yearning.
Okay!
This is the exact same voice that Christy does when she wants to goof on a song.
It is.
It's basically Wayne, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny that you say that. So let's talk quickly about that song. So it's a real song called Be My Love, 1950, lyrics by Sammy Kahn, music by Nicholas Slug Brodsky. Really glad my nickname's not Slug. And it was written for a movie called The Toast in New Orleans for Mario Lanza and Catherine Grayson to sing. It was nominated for the Best Song Oscar, but it lost to Mona Lisa. Shocking. And Mario Lanza did a solo recording of it that went to number one on the pre-Hot 100 Billboard charts. It sold over 2 million copies, and it was the theme to his radio show. It basically became his signature song. And Mario Lanza was a singer who was sort of like the... I don't know, like the Andrea Bocelli, Josh Groban of his day. Yeah. So
he did a lot of movies too.
Yeah. Yeah. So that sort of voice is the kind of voice that he had, just, you know, not quite that goofy.
Too bad. Too bad it wasn't that goofy. So the song doesn't land any better than the impressions did. Mark, who has been at the piano accompanying himself, he then sends Fozzie to the piano. We're still backstage, by the way. Nothing's on stage. He sends Fozzie to the piano to accompany Mark in a dancing comedian routine.
Hey, did you hear about the scientist who crossed a toad with a saxophone? He got a frog horn!
You look sort of green.
Well, I don't know exactly how to put this, Mark, but what else do you do?
I gargle Gershwin.
Mark, I know exactly how to put this. Get out! Out of the theater! We don't need you! Thank you very much, Anita! And don't call us! We'll call you!
Damn.
I was waiting for Kermit to tell him that he was a racist for that joke. Like, first of all, toads and frogs are different. And like, I know I fucking look green, dude. I am green.
Not easy. To your earlier point, David, this of course makes no sense at all because he's already announced him as the guest star and dismissed. They keep saying that Angus McGonagall has been canceled, which I know means his act, but in 2024 it sounds like something else. And I make me laugh every time, unintentionally.
He knows what he did.
Yeah.
Oh God. Well,
we get a new camera angle backstage so that we can see Mark full body, and also R2 will appear in a similar location, which I like when they do that stuff. It's fun. And unlike Big Bird, this one did not ruin the force perspective.
Oh, yeah. I still think about how weird that was.
Yeah. But we do see a bit of Kermit's butt sleeve behind the desk.
Awkward. Yeah. So Mark is kicked out. He goes down the stairs to that stage door exit. And as soon as he leaves, Luke immediately comes through that same exit, barrels through, threatens everybody. And then as soon as he's off screen, Mark pops in from that same exit.
Out of the theater, we don't need you. Thank you very much, Anita. And don't call us, we'll call you.
I didn't get his autograph. All right, nobody leave.
Unless you want to go through life as a rug. Isn't that Luke Skywalker terrific?
It's so cute.
It's a good bit. I don't like that Luke threatens to kill Fozzie, though.
It's a good line, though.
It is a good line. I can't imagine anyone listening to this podcast doesn't know this, but I'm going to say it just in case. The audiences would not have known this at the time, but Fozzie asking for Luke's autograph is especially cute because Frank Oz played Yoda, and they had done that already. And the Henson shop built Yoda and all those things. And I wish we got more of Frank and Mark together, but we'll get some more later.
So as the episode continues, trouble is brewing on stage.
Okay, let's see. Next we have...
Uncle Kermit!
Just one second, Robin. One thing at a time. That's how I'm able to put on this show without falling into a panic. Next we have Pigs in Space. Pigs in Space next, please. Now, what was it?
Well, I was trying to tell you the Star Wars people have hijacked the swine trek.
They hijacked the swine trek!
Well, at least they didn't panic.
So again, what does it mean that they have hijacked the swine trek in the context of the world of the Muppet Show? Have they taken over a sketch that is on stage? Have they actually hijacked a vehicle somehow? Like, what are we to take from Robin's warning here?
We've talked about this before. The lines between reality and fiction and on stage and in universe on both Pigs in Space and Veterinarian's Hospital are very blurry, which does not answer your question.
Although, like, there are episodes of Pigs in Space where Piggy will say, like, we're in a sketch. This is a comedy show.
But then, like, Link will still be the captain, right? Like, right. There's a lot of they play with that a lot, which doesn't answer your question.
Right.
You are correct. It makes
sense. Yes, this is not a unique experience here.
Yeah.
So from a performative sense, Link and Dr. Strange Pork believe that they are in a reality of a spaceship, and therefore the spaceship exists.
Sure.
So because they're on a stage saying it, that's enough to get Luke to wherever he needs to go. We can move on. So on that panic note, we're going to turn things over to Christy for the music, and we're going to pick this up on the swine trek later in the onstage section.
We've got some fun music to talk about this time, but as befitting an episode in which the guest star is Star Wars, let's talk about the Star Wars theme.
Chewbacca the Wookiee!
So yeah, that is the main theme from Star Wars, written by my guy John Williams. And shout out to him and his incredible accomplishments. He has won 26 Grammys, 5 Oscars, including one for Star Wars, and 54 Oscar nominations. He is the second most nominated person ever after Walt Disney. And with his most recent nomination in this most recent Oscar cycle for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, he's also the oldest nominee ever at 91 years old. He's also the only person to be nominated for an Oscar in 7 different decades, which is wild. His other awards include 7 BAFTAs, 3 Emmys, and 4 Golden Globes. And here is a wild thing that I learned last night. His son Joseph was the lead singer of Toto. Not during the period that most of their hits came out. But
still.
Yeah. And he was also the singing voice of the adult Simba in The Lion King.
You know, he also wrote or co-wrote the 2 songs from Return of the Jedi that got replaced in the special edition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, do you know who his mom is?
Who's
Joseph Williams's mom is Barbara Ruick, who is Carrie Pippridge in the film of Carousel.
Oh yeah. Anyway, I love John Williams. This is not a John Williams podcast. I won't turn it into one, but
we've hijacked the swine track. This is now also a John Williams podcast.
Laughing Neck is a banger, and shame on them for cutting it.
It's true.
I just a little thing, that's very nerdy and that surprise that illustrates what Christy's talking about how good he is and just like how musical storytelling works. In the 90s, there was this multi-CD box set of the Star Wars trilogy score, which I still have. I can't play it on anything, but I still have it. There were alternate tracks, and there's a famous scene in Star Wars where Luke is staring out at the sunset and there are 2 suns because it's not Earth and yada yada. And as I understand it, John Williams sort of saw that and was like, oh, it's a weird science fiction thing. And so he wrote a weird science fiction track to go over it. And then George Lucas was like, no, that is not the vibe at all. And they replaced it with Luke's theme. And you can compare them on YouTube and we'll put it in the show notes. The original version is like, I am never getting the fuck off this planet. This is the worst place in the world. And the final version is I'm hopefully looking to the horizon. And it's exactly the same visual, and the music completely changes the entire tone of the scene. And it's like just such a good example of that. And I actually sometimes pull it out when people tell me they don't like musicals.
Whoa, 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 I've got a girl named Ram-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-ding-dong. She's everything to me. Ram-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-ding-dong. And I will set her free, cause she is mine, all mine.
This is Ram-a-lam-a-ding-dong, which in the Muppet Show incarnation is sung by a bunch of sheep and other various barnyard animals, and it's delightful. But this is a song from 1957 that was a hit by the Edsels. It was written by their lead singer, George Wydell Jones Jr. Wydell, a much better nickname than Slug. And it yes. was initially released in 1958 under the title Lam-a-ram-a-ding-dong.
Oh, twist.
And they re-released it in 1961 because it gained some popularity thanks to a New York City DJ who played it as an outro from the doo-wop version of Blue Moon by the Marcells. And it hit number 21 on the Hot 100. And this has been a weird theme in our episodes lately. It's the official goal song of the German football club VfL Wolfsburg.
Sure.
I can hear that being like a fun thing to like, it's like, go, ding dong, like that. I get it. But yeah, I could watch the first part of this on a loop, at which the first part of this actually interpolates some Bach. Bach's aria Sheep May Safely Graze, which is actually a good joke.
That is a good joke.
Nifty. I could watch the end of this on a loop. So it's sung by a shepherd and a shepherdess, and also by a bunch of sheep. And at the end, they just launch themselves into the air, much as Muppet penguins would. But it turns out that there is a whole different flavor of joy in watching Muppet sheep launch themselves into the air. This is a delight.
The laugh track usually just kind of does its thing. But in this, like, half of the laugh track gets the joke early. Like, the second they start transitioning into Ram-a-lam-a-ding-dong, like some fake people are like, I get it, they're rams. And I don't know, there's like a verisimilitude to that that I just love.
Rams and lambs.
Yeah, that's true.
I do appreciate how literal this is.
I just really love that. I think this is a nice showcase for what a great singer Richard can be. Although it's interesting, as the song goes on, I think he gets a little tired and his voice gets a little pitchy. But like with like a little bit of training, I think he could have been like a real singer and not just someone who sings behind puppets. And you know, it's nice that he gets that showcase.
Yeah, this and Placido Flamingo. I mean, he sounds exactly like a singer for this kind of song is supposed to.
Yeah.
He sounds right for this.
With this song, both times I watched it recently, I found myself curious about the shepherd and his singing like, ooh, I got this gal and she's all mine. And then later he's like, I think she's mine. I'm pretty sure. And it goes from this very like, ooh, there's this girl I'm romancing to like, are other boys talking her up? Is she mine, all mine?
Only
I really don't
know. For sure.
What are you sheep doing? Yeah.
So we can't just be promised that Angus McGonagall is a gorgeous Gershwin gargler and not hear it. Why, yes, that counter melody is coming from none other than Mark Hamill.
I love that we've gotten not only the payoff for this, you know, Chekhov's gargling from Angus McGonagall, but also Mark Hamill said that he gargles Gershwin, and we got the payoff for that, too. I wasn't expecting it.
For the record, I propose that each of us try to gargle Gershwin, and I was outvoted.
Sidebar, it just occurred to me that Mark's adorable sweater vest is, in fact, Argyle. The pattern.
Oh.
Yeah.
Twist. Yeah. But yeah, he sneaks up behind Angus McGonagall and like shushes the audience so that they won't give away that he's there. And then he just like does this goofy arm flapping thing and sings back up. Oh, I love it.
So this is Summertime from Porgy and Bess from 1934. Music by George Gershwin. Lyrics, not that we hear them, by DuBose Hayward and Ira Gershwin. And the version from the 1959 movie of Porgy and Bess was number 52 on the AFI 100 Years 100 Songs list that we have mentioned many times. And here's a fun fact. From the 2017 Guinness Book of World Records, there are thousands of different versions of the Beatles' 1965 hit Yesterday and John Newton's 1779 hymn Amazing Grace on record, but George Gershwin's jazz standard Summertime is considered to be the most recorded song, with a staggering 67,591 recorded versions in existence as of June 1st, 2017. This is according to the Summertime Connection, a group of fans from around the world with a shared passion for the aria. And as of the same date, the group had collected over 57,000 full recordings of Summertime, and it's been recorded by all sorts of people. So, funnily enough, I then went down a rabbit hole trying to find the Summertime Connection, and didn't find it, but who knows? Maybe someday we'll find it.
There it is.
Yeah, so that's pretty wild. I don't know. I didn't follow up to see if the record still holds, but I would assume so.
I wonder if this made their list, the gargled Gershwin version.
I'm sure it did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm a little disappointed that the second time Angus McGonagall comes out to gargle Gershwin, that is the same song, and that we don't get to hear him do a second Gershwin song.
Yeah. I would love to have heard Rhapsody in Blue, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, especially if Mark backs him up. That would be nifty. The enormous dopey grin on Mark Hamill's face. It looks like gargling Gershwin on the stage of the Muppet Theater is a lifelong dream for him, and that fulfilling it is just throwing him into this absolute ecstasy. Like, he's just so happy to be here.
Apparently, the Muppet performers had a difficult time figuring out what exactly it would mean to gargle Gershwin. And they had all sorts of, like, workshopping sessions trying to figure it out, where I think they originally tried to do it so that they could also have lyrics, and then realized that it's impossible to gargle and sing and produce words at the same time. And so I think where they landed is that whichever performer is doing the gargling is not the performer who is otherwise performing Angus and doing his spoken words. Muppet Wiki has the whole story. I did not write it down, but if you're curious, you should be visiting Muppet Wiki after every one of our episodes to see what else you can learn.
I would expect that all of the listeners are doing that.
All right. So now on to what I consider to be the low point of this episode.
Hey, down in the meadow in the little bitty pool swam three little fishies and a mama fishy too.
Swim,
said the mama fishy.
Swim if you can.
And they swam and they swam all over the dam.
Boop, 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 diddum, dottum, wadum.
And they swam and they swam all over the dam.
Yeah, so this is a song called Three Little Fishies from 1939 with lyrics by Josephine Carringer and Bernice Idens and music by Saxy Dowell. And Saxy was also a nickname. The guy's name was actually Horace, and he shockingly played the saxophone. And
not the Dowell?
It was a number one hit for Kay Kaiser and his band in 1939. And it's been recorded extensively since as both a novelty song and a children's song. And Thog actually performed it on Dick Cavett in 1971, and that is delightful. But Thog is always delightful. This, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, it's just dull. It's just fish, and I don't know. It's missing... It's a little too...
It's on the nose.
Straight for me, no, yeah.
It's on the nose, but it's not. Like, it makes no dramaturgical sense at all, because they're sort of acting out the story in terms of the three fish getting away from their parents, I guess. But they're clearly in, like, a little pool in a meadow, is the lyric, I think. And then, like, they have to jump over a dam to get to a larger body of water, and thus the danger. But they're clearly in the deep ocean for this entire thing. And once I noticed that, it really bugged me. Like, it's just a painted backdrop. Just make a couple different painted backdrops.
If you're not watching along, the main male voice that we hear is attached to the eel, who we might remember from the number When I'm Not Near the Fish I Love. And the antagonist is the shark from I Want Some Seafood, Mama.
I think this is cute, despite what I just complained about.
Yeah, it's cute. It's the slowest point in an otherwise wonderful episode.
Right, as the UK spot often is.
This also definitely suffers from the it's not a song I already know problem.
Oh, that's interesting, because this is definitely a song I remember from childhood, and I would have assumed this is why, but since it was the UK spot, that's probably not true, unless they re-edited stuff in reruns. So yeah, this was a childhood standard for me.
It feels more Sesame Street than Muppets for me.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause
if they had included this on one of those compilation videos that I had as a kid, I'm sure now I would be sitting here telling you how much I love it and how wonderful it is to revisit it.
Yeah. It's a cute song. Cool looking puppets. It's just in the Star Wars episode of The Muppet Show.
I didn't understand all of it, but I'm certain the English people enjoyed it.
Speaking of songs that are beloved from VHS compilations, let's let Scooter take it away.
In my room I practice late, they'd leave me alone. My mother said, you're nothing yet to make the folks right home. And so I dream a bass will join me and fill the bottom in. And maybe now some lead guitar so it would not sound so thin. I need some drums to set the beat and help me keep in time. And way back in the distance, a horn would sound so fine. And we'd all play together like fine musicians should. And it would sound like music, and the music would sound good.
I love this. This is a song called Six String Orchestra. It's a Harry Chapin song from 1974 that he recorded on an album called Verities and Balderdash. And the most delightful fun fact I found about the song is that it was recorded in Finnish, and we're assuming that it's real Finnish, but yeah, if we have any Finnish listeners, please let us know, by an artist named Hector, who was a singer-songwriter who translated a lot of English language songs and turned them into Finnish hits.
Päässä voisi antaa vähän pohjaa musiikkiin. Ja soolaskittä, jottei soundi olis ohut niin. Ja rummut pitäis olla, jotta tempoon päästäisiin. Ja jostain kautaa jouset salaa liuvis
I always get Harry Chapin confused with Harry Nilsson. I know that my main reference for Harry Chapin is that Mandy Patinkin covered one of his songs on one of his early albums. Do you have any like context for like, here's what Harry Chapin is famous for? Or
Cats in the Cradle is
that's him
biggest hit. Yeah, he had a song called 30,000 pounds.
That was, yeah, that's my association with him.
Yeah, so this song was on one of the VHS compilations. And I remember it less from the video itself, but because as a kid, I recorded all of the songs from that VHS onto a cassette tape that we listened to in the car. And I hadn't heard this song in probably 30 years. And I immediately knew all the words. And wow. I just was like when it started, I was like, huh, I don't remember Scooter playing the guitar. And then as I started singing, I was like, oh, I do. But I find this weirdly moving. Like, I actually found myself like tearing up a little bit when I watched it. And it hits me in the same way that the song Come Dancing by the Kinks hits me, where that song is a story song about a dance hall that has closed and the singer's memories about it. And it has sort of like a washed out quality. And then at the very end, there is a key change and suddenly everything is big and full. And it's like, you're like back in this ghost of a place. And this hits me in the same way of the like going from like a place of like hopefulness and dream to reality. And just like the, you know, it's like something going from black and white to color. It just, it's wonderful. I love this.
There's something I find really charming about when Scooter is with the full band. And I don't think I've seen Scooter with this hairdo again, but he has like a slicked back look in his like glam rock outfit. Yeah. And I was like, oh, ran a little comb through that Scooter. Look at that.
They went much harder on this than they needed to. And it, both in general and with the read that we all choose to bring to Scooter, which is that he is gay. But so there's the set, the bedroom set that he starts out in, and then there's a fantasy set. And like they decorated the hell out of this bedroom set. It's so good, like, you know, down to the quilt on the bed. And it really makes you feel like this is a child or a teen who is having this elaborate fantasy and, you know, this dream he wants to do. In Scooter's room are multiple college pedants. David, did you want to talk about this at all?
Yeah, it was, I don't know, it struck me as a weird design choice because there's so many and they don't seem to have any particular connection to each other. Like the first ones I noticed were like, there's a big Yale one and then there's a Harvard one. And I was like, oh, maybe these are all Ivy League, but then there's Syracuse and there's one that says Boston, which I assume is for Boston University, not just Boston, the town, but who knows? Cause there's also one for the Yankees, which is not a college as far as I know. so you know, the Boston one could just be for a sports team. And so, like, it was a little weird. And also, when I was whatever age Scooter is supposed to be in this, I also had a bunch of pennants like that up on my walls. I think mine were mostly sports teams, not colleges. And I wasn't a sports fan. It was just, like, the kind of thing that, like, it was probably, like, a very cheap souvenir to get when you went to a baseball game. And that's why I had them.
I definitely, like, as you say that, I can, like, see the shape on my wall. But I can't remember what it said. I have to look through old photos and see if I can figure it out. Yeah, I wonder if it just didn't, none of it would have read at the time. And so they were just pennant shaped, but they wanted to all be different. I don't know.
I have one over there that says despair. I'm very fond of it.
No despair.
Your favorite deadly sin.
Your alma mater.
Amazing.
I suspect that they probably each are a school that either someone on like the Muppet Show build crew went to or has a kid at or something like that.
Yeah, that was my guess.
Like Lisa Henson was at Harvard at the time that this was being filmed.
Mm. That makes sense.
I love the idea that Scooter has applied to all of these schools, and as he gets his like rejection letters, he's just like pulling them off the wall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fuck you, Columbia.
There's also an I Love New York, you know, the logo, the Earhart New York, which is just like, again, like a really nice touch of like, that's where he wants to go. There's a poster of Luke Skywalker right above his bed.
Autographed to him by Luke Skywalker.
Well.
And from the upcoming movie, episode 5.
Right. It's the same, same outfit he's wearing on the show, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, you know, again, if we want to assume what he's doing while looking at that poster. There's also a much smaller picture of Leia, and you know, who among us has not similarly but differently dreamed of Carrie Fisher. There's a lamp that I want. Like I absolutely want his desk lamp.
He's also got a Star Destroyer poster and a C-3PO.
Yeah. The Star Destroyer poster, however, is upside down.
I didn't recognize it on my first watching. I was like, I don't understand what that is. And ignored it because I was focused on Luke. And it wasn't until my second watch that I was like, no, that's a Star Destroyer. I know exactly what that is, but it's upside down.
Really weird. And I just assume an accident, but it was funny that nobody caught it.
Christy mentioned that she had this on a videotape when she was little. That was on the Playhouse Video. There was a series called Playhouse Videos that came out in 1985. Each one was like a compilation hosted by a different Muppet. So this was on the one hosted by Scooter, and he talks about how this was his favorite number, which is probably because he sang it. And Kermitman actually just covered that series on their show. So when you're listening now, you'd have to scroll back a little bit, but it's their March 8th episode, and it's a great episode. So go give them a listen.
There you go. And then the fantasy set is very disco, and there's a mirror behind them, and everybody, including the Mayhem, have new costumes, and it's very glam and very fun.
And Floyd gets this groovy hat. Floyd and Janice are flanking Scooter on this set, and they're in the glitteriest costumes I've ever seen them in, and including Floyd's little cowboy hat that's like this. I love it.
They're living their best ABBA lives.
Yes.
I'm really into it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, since the last two numbers come up during Pigs in Space, we leave you in suspense once again as we turn to show business.
Never mind that jazz. Listen, turkey.
What? And get out of show business?
So this week, our onstage business will pick up with the conclusion of the plot. But first, whatever this is.
Here are the results of today's national sheepdog trials. All the sheepdogs have been found not guilty.
So I guess people knew this at the time, but apparently a sheepdog trial is a dog sport where dogs compete to see who is the best at chasing after a bunch of sheep.
A herd of sheep.
Of course I've heard of sheep, but sheepdog trials are ridiculous.
If it's a dog sport, does that mean like someone is training the dogs to do this? Do people bet on it? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's like a dog show. Like the working group in the dog show has to do the work.
Yeah, there were like...
There's a working group in the dog show?
Have you never watched the Westminster Kennel Club dog show after the Thanksgiving Day Parade?
No.
No?
Well, you should. It's adorable. Show. Like different dog breeds have different backgrounds, and some of them were bred to do things like herd sheep, and that's still a thing in dog shows.
So they make them herd sheep right
now?
No,
not anymore, but I think at the time...
In the photos I looked at, they were herding sheep.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's a thing, but it's not a thing at Westminster, but...
And they were leaping through obstacles, and there were maps of their little obstacle course. And also there were sheep on the obstacle course. It really was ridiculous. Anyway.
If it's not animal cruelty, then I'm into it. If it is animal cruelty, they should shut it down.
No, it's what they were born to do.
It's a fine line.
That excuse has been used to justify a lot of things, Adam.
Fair.
Anyway, on Pigs in Space. Whatever it means in the context of the show, Luke Skywalker, for whatever he means in the context of this show and the performance that he's giving us, and C-3PO and R2-D2 have commandeered the Swine Trek for their mission, but the Swine Trek crew keeps showing up and getting in their way.
Why don't you let me explain? I'm Luke Skywalker. My friends and I have just borrowed your spaceship so we can rescue our friend, Chewbacca the Wookiee.
It's Luke Skywalker. Ooh, one of the heavenly bodies. I'll change.
Now, is there anything else you'd like to know?
Yes, I have one very important question I'd like to ask you.
What's that?
Who's your tailor? I love that outfit.
So, Miss Piggy pops in and pops back out again and reappears with her hair in side buns, claiming to be the princess.
Princess?
Yes, yes, I have just escaped from an evil fiend who held me prisoner.
Well, the evil fiend must feed his prisoner as well.
What?
Well, what I mean is it looks like you've put on...
Look, Skywalker, go along with this or I'll cut you in half.
I love that Piggy is making this go her way, and also, fuck you, Skywalker. What are you doing?
This brand of Piggy fat joke I can get behind, because, like, she is literally a pig, and he is used to Carrie Fisher, who at this time was very skinny, probably thanks to a lot of cocaine. And we could probably cut that.
When I texted several different people at once when I was looking up this episode and said, why did Carrie Fisher never work with the Muppets? And everybody immediately texted me back and said cocaine at the same time.
Fair. Fair. And a great question. She would have been so good. If cocaine or not, she would have been amazing. But like, as opposed to like Piggy being on a diet or whatever, this thing where like somebody makes a crack at her about her, let's say, pigness, and she comes back with a very hearty fuck all the way off. I can work with this.
I also have been really digging in the last couple episodes that I've been listening to her I'll cut you in half new line. I'm used to her hi-yahs, and it just feels like a new, slightly more sinister, and also like, I don't know, I'm kind of into it.
Yeah, just letting you know.
Watching Maud. It is very much in the style of B. Arthur in Maud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just letting you know that she could cut you in two.
So I didn't even get hung up on the fat joke of it all, because I was too busy thinking about how this lives in that weird zone before we knew the truth about Luke and Leia. And
oh yeah,
the, you know, assumptions that that he's the love interest there. Which is, you know, creepy.
There's also, in listening back to the clip, there's something really charming about how, like, Leia would never say any of those words,
right?
But Piggy, as Leia, absolutely would. Like, this is how Piggy would play this role, and these are how the lines would change.
The real Leia would absolutely say, I'll cut you in half.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. No. The like, link, link, link.
Right.
Like, that performance is, like, so Piggy playing Leia, right. But in a world where, like, Leia, it's just a very different Leia. I don't know. I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, she looks great.
I also want to note here, just as Link is asking for Luke's tailor, my friend Becca Breyer, who is a lovely nerd of both Star Wars and Muppet things, pointed out to me as I was getting ready for this episode that this is the debut of Luke's new outfit. We don't actually see this until midway through episode 5 when he's on Dagobah, but there's a couple people throughout the episode who will now ask for his tailor, and they are kind of like drawing special attention to this outfit that, to me, again, as someone who like had been watching Star Wars since before I knew I was watching movies, I'm like, yeah, that's just one of Luke's outfits, and didn't realize like, no, this is the entrance of this outfit. And the Muppet Show seems to be paying special attention to that, too.
Another television first.
They had this funny thing going on between the first two movies where they were like introducing things from Empire in the most bizarre ways. So like Boba Fett as a character debuted as a cartoon segment on the holiday special. Boba Fett as a full-on human being in a costume debuted like at a parade at a state fair.
What?
Yeah. Like, okay. Like, again, they just didn't know exactly where they fit in the culture yet. So all publicity is good publicity.
Nice. So then we have a bonus Muppet News flash.
There's
a bulletin from the Muppet Newsroom. The spaceship Swine Trek is about to make a soft landing on a distant planet. In other planetary news, Venus is about to make a hard landing on the Muppet Newsroom. That doesn't make sense.
What a great sound. That is a statue of Venus, not the planet Venus. Or it's a statue. I don't actually know if it's...
You know, it's the Venus de Milo.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. I only noticed this when I was making the GIF because it's so fast. But throughout the sketch, you can see the shadow of the statue on the newsman and the wall behind him. And then you can see the person pushing the statue over.
And remaining
in frame.
I
just love it because it's so low tech. His shadow, right? You can't actually see. He gets his hands off of it before it's in frame. But you can see his full shadow, like a little silhouette play on the wall, behind. And I just love how low tech it is. Someone just knocked it over.
Yep, that's how we're operating here. That's fine. So the Swine Trek makes a not-so-soft landing on the planet Coosbane, where our heroes encounter Dearth Nader, whom you might remember from the Crystal Gale episode when he invaded the Swine Trek with his chicken stormtroopers. He has more sinister things in mind here.
It's Dearth Nader!
This is Dearth Nader?
Yes, isn't he just a hickey?
Well, what do you want of us, Nader? Well, why don't you say something? Speak!
Who's your tailor? I love that outfit!
So this concludes in the only way a ridiculous Muppet Show plot can.
Terrible! Trapped by Dearth Nader, our weapons useless, and now we're being tortured by gargling Gershwin! Oh! What could possibly get us out of this?
What else? A song and dance number!
You are my lucky star. I saw you from afar. You opened heaven's portals here on earth for us poor mortals. You are my lucky star.
Yep, this is You Are My Lucky Star. Lyrics by noted creep Arthur Freed. Music by Nacio Herb Brown. Best known as one of the songs in Singing in the Rain, the best movie ever made. But it was originally written for the MGM movie Broadway Melody of 1936, which was a Best Picture nominee and part of the Broadway Melody cinematic universe, which included the Broadway Melody from 1929, Broadway Melody of 1938, and Broadway Melody of 1940.
Wow.
And David, this was in a lot of MGM movies, right?
Yeah, it just, like, as listeners know, I've been watching a lot of musicals, especially a lot of lesser-known musicals over the last few years, and I was shocked how often this song popped up. I think MGM owned it outright, more or less, because Arthur Freed was a producer for them, and so it just is constantly being worked into their films, either as a full-on musical number or in the background music. It shows up in Tom and Jerry shorts. Like, it's everywhere. It's sort of like their studio theme song for a while.
Yeah, so after they sing this, Kermit convinces the cast of Star Wars to do some dancing, and C-3PO at first adamantly refuses and then suddenly says, oh, all right, and then just busts out in a tap dance.
He says, I've seen a Fred Astaire film.
Yeah. He's very light on his feet for a droid.
And also, this, on the wiki, there's a thing about how, like, this, probably not this specific set, but, like, the Muppet Show set in general was quite dangerous for Anthony Daniels because he couldn't really see, and there's lots of holes.
Yeah.
So, yikes.
Yeah.
But also, then Chewbacca dances, and also from the wiki, Peter Mayhew has lovely things to say about his Muppet Show experience, but Chewbacca looks fucking miserable. Or possibly very, very high, but, like, he just... I have never seen anybody look like they want to be in a place less than Chewbacca looks while he's dancing.
It feels so weird seeing Chewbacca in this moment because he's not wearing his bandolier, which he almost always wears. But to me, it feels like Chewbacca walks out naked in a way that is like very uncomfortable for me.
Yeah. True.
Mm-hmm. After they've all had their moments, Kermit asks Luke Skywalker to perform and Luke says, oh, I'll go get my cousin. And Mark Hamill pops back in a straw hat and a bow tie and singing When You Wish Upon a Star.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. When you wish
yeah, When You Wish Upon a Star has music by Lee Harlein and lyrics by Ned Washington and was written for Walt Disney's Pinocchio in 1940. It's the winner of the 1940 Best Song Oscar, for those of you playing bingo. And it was the first Disney song to do so. The original version that was recorded for the movie by Cliff Edwards, the voice of Jiminy Cricket, was inducted into the National Recording Registry in 2009. And it's the oldest song to be certified by the RIAA, which I thought was kind of cool. There were multiple hit versions, including a Glenn Miller version that hit number one in the Billboard Record Buying Guide, which was one of the precursors to the Hot 100. And the version from the movie was number seven on the AFI 100 Years, 100 Songs list. And as I probably don't need to tell anyone listening to this, it's the signature theme of the Walt Disney Company, and it's been incorporated into their logo since the 1980s. So actually, not a thing at this moment yet.
But it was still evocative enough that as they were singing it, they have Cinderella's castle or something meant to evoke Cinderella's castle.
Like Darth Vader's castle. Right? It's a scary looking, it's like the nightmare version.
It is a more gothic looking castle. You're right.
Yeah. There's like some like very like earthly looking cathedral windows on it. But then also there's some weird stuff. And like nothing that looked like that would have been in Star Wars yet, but it definitely looks like some later Star Wars things sort of by accident, I guess, but it's fun. I like it a lot.
Yeah. But this castle rises up behind them. And then some of these shooting star effects that we've seen hanging around in the backstage set are now descend over them. That's in the background. And then the cast of Star Wars is there swaying and singing along. And in the foreground, that I cannot overemphasize just how cheesy and saccharine this is as they're throwing their entire being into enjoying it. The Muppets have all linked arms in the foreground, and it's Kermit and Piggy and the crew of the Swine Trek and a couple of Kuzbanians and Angus McGonagall and Darth Nader. And they're all just having the time of their lives singing When You Wish Upon a Star.
I say it is like some dark ass foreshadowing that you have the Muppets and the Star Wars people with a very threatening version of the Disney castle behind them.
Rising up out of the earth, yeah, or out of Kuzbane.
Yeah.
Only thing that's missing is Spider-Man.
Just to note that the Kuzbanians are here too, the little red guys from season one.
But no Kuz babies.
No Kuz babies. Though these probably are the Kuz babies.
All grown up.
Had a couple years to grow up. What's the lifespan of a Kuzbanian? Or how long until they reach sexual maturity?
I don't want to think about it. Anyway, they're adorable. They've always been adorable. And I like that they're here.
No matter how sexually mature they are, they're still adorable.
Oh, Michal, you're going to be just like Angus McGonagall and get canceled.
by Kuzbanians.
Don't you think we ought to introduce my cousin?
Sure. You want to go out and send him in?
Well, that won't be necessary. Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Hamill. Thanks for having us, Kermit. That goes double.
It certainly does.
Say, Luke, who's your tailor? I love that outfit.
So just before this clip, they've done like a whole curtain call sequence where they have announced each of the cast members of Star Wars, although Mark Hamill's the only one who gets to hear his actual name and not his character name. And they come out and like take a bow, like it's the end of a Broadway musical, which feels a little bit like it's filling time. There are a couple of things in this episode that feel like maybe there was another sketch that had been planned that fell through at the last minute. And so we have that like weird insert with Gonzo rehearsing his thing. We have this weird curtain call. I don't know what's going on there.
Scooter rehearsing his thing.
And then at this moment, when Luke brings Mark on, I just think it's like the worst split screen we've ever seen on the Muppet Show. Like, they don't seem like they are in the same space at all.
Hard disagree.
You think that this is good or you think there have been worse?
Both. And I think we've definitely seen worse green screen effects before. And what I think is cool about this is how they did it, which, like, yes, you can tell how they did it. So that's maybe what makes it bad. But for people who aren't watching along, you know, those are sort of the classic like sitcom split screen. I'm pretty sure like they just didn't move the camera and filmed everything twice. And only the person who was doubled would be in the shot. In this, Mark is in the shot with Kermit. They're in the same place. And then I'm pretty sure that's how they did it. And then Luke, second Mark, is is green screened into that shot. And then when Luke says, "Who's your tailor? I love your outfit," there is a cut to a close up and Luke rolls his eyes at him. And when we cut back, it's Kermit and Luke, and Mark is green screened in. So they're able to sort of play with, you know, where Kermit is in front of one of them at all times, which I think sells it. I think it makes it look much more real. And like, yeah, if you look at it closely, you can see where like they sort of overlap by accident.
That's not my issue. My issue is that they're not like in the same, like they're in different places in the depth of the
picture. They're in slightly different proportions.
It's a little bit off. But
and I forget which one is which, but whoever's on the right, like, just it looks like he's trying to look at the version of him on the left, but like he's not making the right eye contact because it's misaligned. Like, it's just terrible.
No, it's not perfect, but I just think it's a cool technique, which would have been very new at the time.
It was a cool idea. They get points for effort.
I'm just delighted that it paid off in such a rewarding way. I really dug it, even if the effect was obvious that they weren't actually on screen at the same time, clearly, but it was worth it.
There is also a fully bonkers Star Wars fan theory, which I truly cannot figure out how. I assume it's a joke. I really can't figure out how real it's meant to be, that there are within the Star Wars movies two Lukes, because apparently Mark Hamill's height relative to the other actors changes like more than it should. Like, yes, that's how movies get made. People stand on boxes, whatever. But like, allegedly, this changes more than it should, which has led to the theory that there's actually two Lukes. And I guess in a comic book or something, there actually is a clone of Luke who is much bigger, with two U's, because Star Wars, Luke. And the only time that the main two Lukes ever appear together is this scene. This is actually part of the theory. This moment, because Mark and Luke are on screen together and are in fact slightly different heights because the technology is not perfect. So that's a weird ass thing that in 40 plus years of being a Star Wars fan, I just learned about this week. So there we go.
When you say the two Lukes, and earlier you said second Mark, that makes this all sound very biblical.
You think there's life in outer space?
There's certainly none in this theater.
Well, we got there. All right. Well, before we say goodbye, Todd, this is the time for you to shine and tell people where to find you should you want to be found.
Yeah, I love being found. You can find me just about everywhere at TB Backus. I am still on Twitter, but not really. But you can find me on Blue Sky, but Twitter being weird kind of broke me of my posting habit. So maybe that's a good thing. I'm there, I just post less. And then you can listen to the podcast that I was a co-producer on, Dungeons and Drama Nerds. It's an examination of the intersection between theater and tabletop role-playing games. We just wrapped our third season, and that's when I stepped back as co-producer. But we have done 11 different game systems where we do full actual play campaigns. And then we look at like the dramaturgy side and we say like, how are the rules? How are the systems affecting the stories that get told in this medium? And then we also kind of ping pong back between like, what are things that theater can learn from tabletop? And what are things that tabletop players can learn from theater?
Sounds like something that fans of this podcast might enjoy a great deal.
They might. It's a fun
one
time.
Of them might live in my household. And I don't mean me, but I'll tell them as soon as we're done.
Oh.
Well, we are so glad that you were able to join us for this and so grateful for the design work you've done for us. And this is probably a good moment to mention that I right now am wearing a Todd Backus design on my body. And you can, too, if you go to MuppetTurgy.com/store.
We won't tell you where on his body. And we'll tell you it's on the back of his shirt.
Thanks for listening to this episode of MuppetTurgy. Join us in 2 weeks for a discussion of the Christopher Reeve episode. You can find us on social media at MuppetTurgy or on the web at MuppetTurgy.com. Buy our merch at MuppetTurgy.com/store. Our theme music was composed and performed by Christy Bauer. Our show logo was created by Todd Brian Backus. And this episode was edited by me, David Levy.
Yay.
Yay.
Woo.
Mayhew shared the role of Chewbacca in The Force Awakens with Yunus. Do anyone know how to say his name?
Not a clue.
With Yunus Suwatamo.
Suwatamo, I think.
Suwatamo.